think just trying to put this on gallery here, so I'm gonna go first and just do a brief introduction to Larry Yang. And this was the book. Oh, I don't know if everybody can see it, but it's called River and I took some excerpts from a chapter from this book that he wrote that the talk is going to be on. It's called Awakening Together, the Spiritual Practice of Inclusivity and Community. Larry Yang is, and just a little bit of a background about the author, Larry Yang. He's a Buddhist meditation teacher and facilitates mindfulness and loving kindness retreats nationally. And has a special interest in creating access to the Dharma for diverse multicultural communities. Larry has practiced meditation for almost 30 years with extensive time in Southeast Asia and a six-month period of ordination as a monastic under the Theravada Buddhist tradition mostly. Larry is on the Teachers Council of Spirit Rock Meditation Center and is one of the core teachers of the East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland. Much of his work has focused on training spiritual leadership within communities of color and LGBTQI communities. Larry was honored for his work in equity and inclusion by being selected as the community's choice for Grand Marshal in the 2016 San Francisco Pride Parade, whose theme was for racial and economic justice. And Larry is also a trained psychotherapist, working primarily with marginalized communities. And he's also a consultant in cultural competency and organizational awareness, giving workshops and presentations on mindfulness and diversity issues.
Hi, all. Thanks for that introduction, Hark. That's really wonderful. So the first reading that we really stood out for Hark and I is from chapter 6, which is titled Refuge in a Multicultural World. And that really spoke to both of us, especially right now. So I'll jump in, and then Hark has a second reading, and then we'll maybe make some comments if that's okay. The Buddha's notions, this is now Larry Yang speaking. The Buddha's notions of freedom and awakening have always accounted for culture, diversity, and the infinite variations in human experience. Within Western insight meditation communities, we are sometimes predisposed to idealize aspirations of spiritual practice and to assume that the highest aim is to transcend the vicissitudes of this life, to somehow obviate the sorrows of this lifetime, so that we can only experience the pleasant, peaceful, or sublime. Thus, I have heard some Dharma teachers avoid talking about diversity and culture, saying something like, "Why dwell on our differences? The point of practice is to see our similarities," as if differences inevitably lead to suffering. But it is a fact that our lives are not just made up of our similarities. Like any manifestation of nature, like any snowflake, leaf on a tree, or shape of a cloud, we all have attributes that are unique and characteristics that are common. It is through seeing the deep nature of our differences and how they are a part of our lives that we can also see the deep similarities of our human experience. We all feel different at some point in our lives. In that experience of difference is a similarity common to us all. Just as we cannot have a life without both joys and sorrows, we cannot have a life without both differences and similarities. The Buddha recognized the importance of culture as a path to freedom. There's a story in the Vinaya, one of the primary scriptural volumes containing the Buddha's teachings for monastics. And this is quoting from the Vinaya. The occasion was this. There were two monastics called Yamalu and Tikula. They were of Brahmin stock, and they had fine voices and a fine delivery. They asked the Blessed One, "Lord, now the monastics are of various names, of various races, variously born, having gone forth from various clans. They spoil the word of the Blessed One by using their own language. Let us render the words of the Buddha into classical meter." The Buddha, the Blessed One, rebuked them. "Misguided men, how can you say, 'Let us render the words of the Buddha into classical meter'? This will not rouse faith in the faithless or increase faith in the faithful. Rather, it will keep the faithless without faith and harm some of the faithful. Having rebuked them, he addressed the monastics thus. Monastics, the word of the Buddha is not to be rendered into classical meter. Whoever does so commits an offense of wrongdoing. I allow the words of the Buddha to be learned in one's own language. But what is the significance of this story? This is now Larry taking this up. The two monastics, who are of the dominant culture and class, were concerned that the teachings of the Buddha were being spoiled by people different from them, assimilating the Dharma to their own cultural linguistic expression. The two suggest that the Buddha codified the spiritual teachings into a singular unified cultural expression, in keeping with their own cultural values. But the Buddha replied in no uncertain terms that his teachings should not be learned in the languages native to the various disciples, in the idiom of, or that it should be learned in the languages native to the various disciples, in the idiom of the people. And this point is essential to understanding the deeper level of the Buddha's intention. The Buddha lived in a historical time before written script. This means that all communication of his teaching was oral. In the absence of the printed word, it was very difficult for languages to survive and thrive outside the geographic area of their cultures of origin. Thus, a specific language was one of the determinants of a specific culture. Language and culture mutually influence each other in significant ways. We can see the message implicit in the Buddha's statement above is that it is misguided to offer teachings in only one cultural form or to somehow impose homogeneity on Dharma practice. It is the Buddha's opinion that teachings should be offered in the context of the practitioner's own culture.
Thank you, River. And I'm going to continue on with the same chapter and a different section that I'm going to read out here too. At a recent Buddhist speakers conference, there was an exercise in which attendees were invited to write down a question they considered important to discuss at the gathering. Anonymously, participants informally voted on the questions so created. One of the questions read something like, when can we end the proliferation of special interest retreats like LGBTIQ and people of color and return to the unity of one Sangha? The allusion to the one Sangha is an incomplete reference to the unity of our common existences in the realm of absolute truth. But as we know, within the teachings on truths, there are two truths, both equal in their importance, the relative and the absolute. Spiritual freedom is not about privileging one truth over the other, not about imposing the absolute over the relative, or preferring the relative over the absolute. To do either negates so much of being human in the simultaneity of our different cultural experiences and common universal experience, and performs what John Wellwood has classically described as a spiritual bypass. In a recent interview, Wellwood describes this phenomena in these words. Spiritual bypassing is a term I coined to describe a process I saw happening in the Buddhist community I was in, and also in myself. Although most of us were sincerely trying to work on ourselves, I noticed a widespread tendency to use spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, and unfinished developmental tasks. When we are spiritually bypassing, we often use the goal of awakening or liberation to rationalize what I call premature transcendence, trying to rise above the raw and messy side of our humanness before we have fully faced and made peace with it. And then we tend to use absolute truth to disparage or dismiss relative human needs, feelings, psychological problems, relational difficulties, and developmental deficits. And that's the end of the quote by Wellwood. So now I'm returning back to Larry Yang. A spiritual bypass implies a shortcut and the tendency of the mind to incline towards the pleasantness of obviating the complexity and messiness of human differences by prescribing unconditional harmony and homogeneity upon the collective experience. This artificial imposition of one-sided truth only creates more suffering. We know that we need to go through the first noble truth in order to see the other side of suffering, to gain freedom from it. If we circumvent, repress, deny, or bypass the first noble truth, we will only create more suffering in the future. This is true of any experience in our lives. We need to turn toward it in order to fully comprehend, fully feel, and fully live that experience. The same is true for our cultural experiences. We need to go through the uniqueness of each of our lives in order to live the connection and interrelatedness that is beyond the differences. Shinryu Suzuki writes in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, strictly speaking, there are no separate individual existences. There are just many names for one existence. Sometimes people put a stress on oneness, but this is not our understanding. We do not emphasize any point in particular, even oneness. Oneness is valuable, but variety is also wonderful. Ignoring variety, people emphasize the one absolute existence. But this is one-sided understanding. In this understanding, there is a gap between variety and oneness. But oneness and variety are the same thing. So oneness should be appreciated in each existence. John Wellwood comments later in the same interview mentioned above that, and this is his quote, "We need a larger perspective that can recognize and include two different tracks of human development, which we might call growing up and waking up, healing and awakening, or becoming a genuine human person and going beyond the person altogether. We are not just humans learning to become Buddhas, but also Buddhas waking up in human form, learning to become fully human. And these two tracks of development can mutually enrich each other." And the following is an excerpt from another chapter in the book, from A Sense of Belonging, I think the title was. This is Larry Yang. "A part of my experience in learning my craft as a Dharma teacher is to learn from the example of my own teachers about what they did well and also what they did not do so well. We all learn by positive and negative examples from our role models. In my current teaching, I endeavor to meet practitioners however they self-identify, not denying any aspect of their background or cultural experiences. Especially in one's entry into the Dharma, invoking the complex teaching of not identifying with oneself can be experienced as a spiritual bypass of a practitioner's reality in the world's external condition. Telling practitioners to simply, quote unquote, sit with their feelings and thoughts may not be a sufficient reflection or respect for their realities and life issues. Naming how I have been caught in the complex feelings of identity and intersections of multiple identities can invite connection and relationship with the practitioner's own experience. From a teacher, this kind of self-disclosure can build the relational connection so that the Dharma can be shared." And that's the end.
Thanks, Hark. That's such a great, I just really love that chapter. And when Hark and I were looking over chapter 6, Hark pointed out that section in chapter 8, and it was just really wonderful how Larry Yang came back to this concept of spiritual bypass in such a beautiful way. So I'll say a couple words about how this reading landed with me, and then pass it back over to Harkamal. This sense of the Dharma as being carried forward not just by static written teachings, but also by living, breathing people is something that is really precious to me. In our tradition, I've heard some folks use the expression of warm hand transmission, which is an expression that I've always really appreciated. in part because it feels so vivid and tactile, if not a little bit sweaty on warm nights like tonight. I don't know how it is where you are, but here I'm kind of sweating through my clothes. In my practice, I've had these moments of really being dazzled when a teacher, mentor, or beloved Dharma friend expresses a familiar practice or teaching in a way I never would have imagined. But then once they share it in that way, it makes total sense to me. It feels like someone's handing me something that I've drawn. Maybe you've also had this experience. And I feel Larry Yang is actually saying something really special here. He's taking this a little bit further along. He seems to be reminding me that these warm hands aren't all the same, that they have different shades. They belong to men, women, and to a whole spectrum of genders. Some of them are rough with physical work. Some have been made beautiful by long years of life, and some are just getting started in the business of living. These hands all offer the Dharma in their own unique way. And that seems totally miraculous to me. It doesn't quite seem like an accident either. It feels like what Larry is saying is that the Dharma always finds a home in the unique cultural and personal circumstances of its followers, that there can be no other way. Something personal, intimate, that I shouldn't be able to receive from anyone but myself is somehow passed along to me and becomes a part of my own life. It's like the moon taking the shape of a dewdrop, to borrow an expression from Dogen. The Dharma feels complete even as it's expressed in all of these different ways. And I know that I'm not a passive recipient in this exchange. Being in Sangha for me also means sharing Dharma as it manifests in my own life. As someone who occupies a queer body and heart, I have something to offer if I'm brave enough to be open and vulnerable. And I haven't always been open and vulnerable with the people who care for me in Sangha. In a way, I feel that what Larry Yang is inviting me to do is to share in the learning of the words of the Buddha in the language of my own life. As a person with white skin and many privileges, like educational privilege, class privilege, and as someone who's descended from people who displaced indigenous nations to settle this land, that's also part of the process of encountering and responding to my life. This isn't always a dazzling experience for me. It can be really uncomfortable. And so I really appreciate Larry Yang's warning of spiritual bypassing. As a child, I remember starting to feel a profound discomfort with my body. I remember being in grade 5, hugging my math teacher, who I did not like, to try and survive a terrifying panic attack. I responded to these negative sensations by becoming very disconnected from my body for a long time. And I think for me, the beginning of that healing was coming to practice Zazen, where there was no escape for me from being in relationship with my body and heart. But I did try. For the first few years of my practice, I really felt that Zen practice meant I would be able to somehow rise above those sensations. And as Larry Yang says, obviate the complexity and messiness of human differences by prescribing unconditional harmony. I really like that phrase. It's a mouthful, though. As Larry Yang puts it so concisely. And so probably that was one of the reasons why I sought out Zen practice in the first place, this idea of being able to fast forward through the messiness of my own life. Well, not so fast, River. Learning this about my relationship to my own identity, knowing I can't somehow rise above being queer, above the messiness of my own life, has also helped me acknowledge that I can't rise above my whiteness, and it also means that I can't expect Dharma siblings of color or women in my community to leave their identity at the Zendo door, just because that's what would be comfortable for me. So I can't expect them to learn to speak in the cultural language that is normal or expected for me or for someone of my race, educational background, or class, or the classical meter of my society. So I really appreciate this idea of resting in oneness. I think sometimes it's great to come back to the truth of oneness and to really take refuge in that as well. But ignoring variety, emphasizing the one absolute existence, I really hear Larry Yang when he says, that's not quite it. What does it mean for a Buddha to wake up in River's body or in River's mind? And how do I express that in community? I have absolutely no idea. But I hope you'll all play at being Buddhas with me so that we can find out together. As Larry Yang says over and over in each chapter of his book, which I really recommend you read, and I think Harkamal is going to also endorse this book, waking up together is really the only way we're going to do this thing. We're all in this perfect pickle together. Thank you.
Thank you, River. That was really eloquently put. I'm going to hear just my commentary here on the section that I had read out. So there was that one line, quote, "The Buddha recognized the importance of culture as a path to freedom," unquote. That really resonated in particular with me. This is not something I come across from teachings by Western Buddhist teachers. When I read that line, the reading also reminded me of my own personal experiences within Western Dharma settings, whereas I always struggled with a sense of belonging in a community. This theme of struggling to belong in a community has been something I have been carrying for a long time. And I find it's also a little bit ironic as my last name, my namesake, is actually Sangha. I think this is rooted in part to my earlier lived experience of being a child of Punjabi-speaking immigrants who immigrated here to Canada in the 1970s. Even though I was born here in Canada, I was raised for most of my childhood in a small farming village in northern India, in the state of Punjab. When I immigrated back here, when I was around 8 or 9, a little bit younger, I struggled in many ways to belong. Back then, I actually had a turban, or what we call in Punjabi, a guti. And my skin color, along with my indicators of my Sikh identity, were often sources of much ridicule and harassment, rooted to racism and xenophobia. So growing up, I just knew that I felt different from other kids around me. I knew from an early age that something about my skin color and indicators of my Sikh identity, it made others treat me differently. The opposite of acceptance and kindness. And carrying this internalized shame and racism made it difficult to belong in many spaces, including Dharma spaces. And it wasn't just solely due to the makeup of a largely white audience, which I visibly felt in many retreats as well, and still continue to, but also personally experiencing what Larry describes as teachers or practitioners drawing on the term one Sangha, or invoking the important teaching of even non-self to spiritually bypass sometimes difficult issues to explore, I think, for any marginalized individual. When it comes to matters of race, culture, and identity. So when Larry references drawing on the first noble truth to turn toward our own cultural experiences in order to go through the uniqueness of each of our lives, in order to live the connection and interrelatedness that is beyond differences, that really helped to situate my own suffering with aspects of my own cultural and racial identity within the realm of emptiness, just to make that link between the absolute and the relative in that way, I just found for myself it was healing to me. As Larry points out, when we are in Sangha, in which we aren't encouraged to name how we are caught in the complex feelings of identity and intersections of multiple identities, that can invite disconnection into the practitioner's own experience. For myself, this is why I am so grateful to be a member of Mountain Range Zen. Compared to my experiences with other Dharma settings prior to immersing myself in Soto Zen, this Sangha values diversity and inclusivity. Larry Yang really helps to broaden my understanding of what it means to take refuge in a Sangha. This is a line in his chapter where he states, it is important to explicitly state that Sangha community is very much about culture as well. And I'm so grateful for teachers such as Michael and Kate who have made this a very special inclusive space. As Larry Yang emphasizes the importance of using culture as a means towards liberation, I find that teachers such as Michael and Kate have also encouraged me to use aspects of my own cultural identity as a Dharma door itself. For myself, the Zen community, the Sangha, is a refuge in the sense it provides enough safety for me to pay loving attention to parts of my identity rather than to ignore, bypass, or repress. And as River so eloquently quoted earlier, well, what does it mean for a Buddha to wake up in heart, mouth, body, and mind? I just really appreciate what that question River had posed. And thank you. That's the end of my commentary.
Harkamal and I, luckily, I've been saved by Larry Yang's well-prepared book because he included questions at the end of each chapter. So that's wonderful. We didn't have to think of any. And maybe I'll maybe we could each say one, Harkamal. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's good. And Kate and Michael, are you all right to put people into breakout rooms after this? Is that?
Hang on, unmute.
Oh.
Yes.
So if you give us the questions, then we'll put people into groups of three, and if there might be an odd group or two of four, and each person will have about 3 minutes to respond to the questions. You can choose, you know, what way you do. And the others will just listen. So it's not a discussion. It's a practice of speaking and listening from the heart. And we'll try and give you a little message to say next to help you time yourselves. When it's time for the next person to go, and then we'll give you a 1 minute warning before we zoom you back out of your breakout rooms. Okay, and I just want to take this opportunity to thank River and Harkamal so much for not only for presenting Larry Yang so beautifully, but for offering your own voices, which. Yeah, I just feel really moved and grateful. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you both. Okay, questions. Ready, go.
Okay, I'll do the first one. What could you do? Who could you envision yourself to be if you fully felt the benefits of refuge?
And I'll do the second question. How is your sense of refuge determined by your cultural experience, your culture of origin, or the cultures of your own familial lineage? Again, how is your sense of refuge determined by your cultural experience, your culture of origin, or the cultures of your own familial lineage?
Maybe River, you could repeat your question for people here a second time.
So again, what could you do? Who could you envision yourself to be if you fully felt the benefits of refuge?
Okay, here goes. If anyone needs to leave.
Who could you envision yourself to be if you fully felt the benefits of refuge?
Okay. I guess I'll just go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just if anybody needs to leave. I think if you could leave now before we put you into rooms, so that way it doesn't get kind of skewed.
Okay, here goes. Now it's done.
Things weird.
You don't usually do that.
No, it's recreate.
Twenty into six, yeah, okay. Yeah. Automatically. Okay, here goes. Let's switch to gallery view so we can see them disappear. And I don't have a watch on, so I'll have to use that. So once they're all in, let's get to put Todd somewhere.
No, he's just has to do it. He's frozen.
Oh, that'll be okay. There he goes. Okay, there they look. They look reasonably, yeah. So, okay, so
7:38. I should.
Well,
that's 3 minutes.
Yeah, 8:38. We'll give them